First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Parents turn to the courts as classes begin across Florida. Good morning. We're live on this first day of school from Studio 5, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Just ahead, why parents around the state are joining two separate lawsuits fighting the governor on safety procedures for kids. 549-2937. Give us a call, everybody. Then later, we'll tell you why some restaurants are bringing back mask requirements around town. But first, as I mentioned, it is the first day of school in Duval County. Parents and teachers are on edge as kids go back to class with the Delta variant of coronavirus raging through the region. Now, about 3.7% of Duval County Public School parents signed a form opting their child out of wearing a mask this school term. Duval County, along with six other school districts around the state, is mandating masks for students. So several thousand kids are opting out. The rest will be masked up. The St. John's County School Board is meeting as we speak under increasing pressure from parents and doctors in that district to do the same thing. But so far, St. John's is resisting a mask mandate. And more news to share this morning. There are now two lawsuits filed on behalf of Florida parents. One complaint is at the state level. The other is a federal complaint. Parents are suing the governor after his order to ban mask mandates in Florida public schools. Governor DeSantis is even threatening to dock the pay of school officials who defy him and require masks on campus. This morning, we're welcoming the attorneys behind both of these complaints on behalf of parents around the state, beginning with attorney Charles Gallagher of Gallagher and Associates Law Firm in St. Petersburg. Mr. Gallagher, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you. Also with us, attorney Stephanie Langer of the Disability Independence Group in Miami. Stephanie Langer, good to have you as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. And parents and everybody around the community listening, what are your questions about these lawsuits on this first day of school in Jacksonville? 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. In a moment, Stephanie, we'll talk about your complaint in federal court, and this is on behalf of students with disabilities on 504 and IEP plans. That is in just a moment. But first, let's begin with Charles Gallagher. You filed a complaint at the state level going directly after the governor's executive order banning masks for students. Multiple plaintiffs from across the state have joined this action. Tell us about this lawsuit.
Sure. So Friday night, we were able to file up in Leon Circuit Court. We make a number of attacks upon the governor's order. First and foremost, that it's unconstitutional under Florida's Constitution for two basic reasons. Number one, under the Florida Constitution, there is a safe schools entitlement. Those in schools and public schools in Florida have the right to be in a safe place, in a safe school, and we believe that the order infringes upon those rights of students, putting them in peril, and not just prospective risk, but actual peril on first day of school they walk in there. The second argument has to do with a little more nuanced government issue and the idea of home rule. So under the Florida Constitution, there's an entitlement for individual school boards and those elected as representatives of those school boards to be responsible for the oversight and management of their school districts. And this order divests all 67 counties' school boards of that right, imposing a one-size-fits-all approach that doesn't take into account the issues for each and every school board in the state of Florida. So it's a home rule issue where these different districts are entitled to govern themselves the way they see fit, pursuant to the electorate in those various districts.
By our count, Charles Gallagher, seven districts so far are implementing mask mandates for students of some kind or another. Duval County, Alachua County, Broward and Palm Beach counties, Orange and Hillsborough counties, Lee County, Leon County. I think it's up to eight counties now, actually. Now, the governor has said he will dock the pay of school officials that defy him on this. Some of those officials around the state have already put out statements saying, go ahead, dock our pay. We're going to continue with this because we think it's the safest route for kids. What about the governor's threat to pull the paychecks of school officials?
There is no legal support for that. The idea that there can be a fiat to all districts to act a certain way by the governor, and if you don't do that, we're going to take your pay, is not supported by Florida law. So you'd have additional litigation, I believe, ensue if there was $1 taken from each school district or any school district administrator out there. I just don't see any support for that under Florida law, and I think that that's universally held among attorneys who have spoken on that issue.
It's 549-2937. As we learn more this morning about two different lawsuits on behalf of Florida parents as school begins around the state, a state lawsuit and a federal complaint. Let's turn now to attorney Stephanie Langer. You are with the Disability Independence Group in Miami. Your firm has filed in federal court on behalf of Florida students with disabilities. Tell us about this complaint.
So good morning again, and thank you for having us. So our complaint is asking that the governor's mandate and executive order, or refusal to allow mandates in his executive order, is interfering with the districts from complying with federal protections that exist for students with disabilities. And so we are also asking for the governor to move out of the way so the districts can do what they need to do to protect all their students. Students with disabilities have extra protections, and they have the right to be educated with, integrated with their peers. And this is preventing students from returning to school safely.
Can you talk a little bit about why kids on a 504 plan or an IEP plan, kids with different kinds of disabilities, in your estimation, are at more risk?
So a lot of kids who have disabilities have underlying health conditions such as asthma, or they're more susceptible to lung infections. And when they get sick normally, they'll end up being much more sick than other children, or they'll end up needing to be hospitalized. And so with COVID and the type of virus that it is, any kids that have any kind of respiratory weakness are impacted more. The concern is greater for those children getting severely sick or hospitalized or even facing death if they get the COVID-19 virus. And so that is why we are seeking to protect children with disabilities, because if we protect our most vulnerable children, we will make it safe for all kids to return to school.
And so let me ask you, Stephanie, what I asked the other attorney we have this morning, Charles Gallagher. What about the governor doubling down on this? Florida has about 7% of the national population, but we have 1 in 5 COVID cases. We are the national epicenter for this disease right now. What about the governor's position that he is advocating on behalf of parents who choose not to mask their children?
So he's ignoring the law that exists to protect children with disabilities, and he's excluding them from the public school system and not providing any reasonable or possible alternatives for those children to attend school this year. And it feels cruel, because last year this vulnerable population of students suffered because it was really hard for them to participate in distance learning, and a lot of those students lost virtually a year of academic instruction, and now we're going to exclude them again for a second year. These are the students that need to be in school the most, or they need to be provided with alternatives that are inclusive as possible. And right now, they have neither. They cannot return to school safely, and they aren't being provided the alternative because the state has cut the funding and specifically told the districts that they're not allowed to have virtual learning that is that is the same as the students are receiving in the classroom live. So they will not have access to the same classrooms or the same teachers or the same curriculum that they would get if they were able to go in person. And so mm-hmm. we've cut off the ability of these students to return safely, and we provided no reasonable alternatives for them to attend. And so they're being pushed out of the public school system altogether. And that is discrimination.
We will go to calls in a moment, 549-2937 and tweets. Speaking of all the tweets, let me ask both of you this question. I'll begin with you, Stephanie, then you, Charles. Lots of tweets about this, but the overriding question we're getting from listeners is, how can we join these complaints? Stephanie, let's begin with the federal complaint on behalf of kids with disabilities. Is this a class action? Can more parents join it?
It is not a class action, but yes, more parents can join it. They just need to call our office, 305-669-2822, and we will be amending our complaint to include any parents who have students with disabilities with an IEP or a 504 plan who are interested in joining.
Okay.
We think it's important for the government and the school districts to know how important this issue is for these families who've been struggling for the last year and months.
We'll repeat that information in a moment. Charles Gallagher, are parents eligible to join your complaint that's being filed in state court?
So our goal is really laser speed, and amending would add time to the process. So we have our plaintiffs set, and we're not amending our complaint to join any individual plaintiffs. However, the relief that we seek in our suit will necessarily benefit all of the school-going public within Florida. Our relief we're requesting is to have the executive order stricken as it's unconstitutional.
549-2937 as we speak with two different attorneys this morning on the show from two different parts of the state. There are two different lawsuits moving now on behalf of parents and kids pushing back against the governor's ban on mask mandates for students in Florida schools. This as classes begin today in Duval County, and there's a protest outside the school board meeting right now in St. Johns County over all of this. 549-2937. Javon is calling from Tampa. Hi, Javon. How are you?
I'm doing well. I literally just dropped off my eighth graders for the first day of school down here. And Ron DeSantis doesn't speak for me. He doesn't speak for the teachers that need to be protected. A mask mandate is a basic protection that will keep people alive. And I would encourage everybody to join in if you have students who need additional protections. I'm going to be writing to my school district and to the governor's office to say that he needs to back off and let the school districts do their job and protect the students and protect teachers with some basic health and safety measures like a mask mandate.
And Javon, are you in Hillsborough County?
I am.
Isn't there a mandate? Isn't there a mandate in that county? Or correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, so far as I know there is, but my daughter went to school with a mask on this morning. You know, mandate or not, we're doing everything we can to protect our family.
All right, thanks for that call. Charles Gallagher, I believe you are also in Hillsborough County. And so, you know, let me ask you, Charles, what's your message to parents out there who are really resisting these kinds of mandates for their kids? They don't believe the science that shows that universal mask wearing really limits the transmission of this virus. They are arguing they should have the choice not to mask their child. Some districts are providing them with opt-out forms as being done here in Duval County. What's your message to those parents?
There are two main points to that. Number one is the opportunity cost of having mandatory masks in schools is that of inconvenience for students and parents. The opportunity cost of allowing optional masks for students is going to be sick and ill and dying children as a result of Delta. And that leads into the second point is Delta is different. You know, last year we had only the Alpha variant to deal with, and there was a great beneficiary of not having kids be too terribly sick from Alpha. Now many kids were sick, many kids died, many kids had horrible health consequences as a result of Alpha, but Delta is different. Distilling it down to one small phrase, Delta's viral load is over 1,000 what Alpha was. We have increased transmissibility on the same line of chicken pox, which is probably the most transmissible disease that we've had in current history. So the idea that last year's numbers, last year's data, last year's stats might be a harbinger for this year, no way, no how. Delta's different. The Delta variant is a nasty, nasty beast that is changing kids, changing illnesses in the schools. And if there's not some action taken quickly, we're going to have more of a statewide emergency than we do now.
Mm. Ann in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a child who entered the fourth grade today, and she has a peer who is a disabled child in the classroom with her. We are trying to promote the use of masks as well as HEPA filters in the classrooms. We're in Duval County.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to lose our choice in our magnet school, which is a wonderful school that has the philosophy of care for self and care for others. I just wanted to say, as a parent, I thank both of you all who are there representing us and our voice and our children and trying to protect our children. It felt like intent to harm. And that's just what I want to say about it as a person who has looked at the science, been told by the pediatricians what is safe, what is not safe, the CDC. This looks like intent to harm, and especially knowing that 85% of the pediatric cases that do result in more harm to the child do exist among the Black and brown communities. It feels like intent to harm from our governor, and I thank you both for your voices and for what you're doing to try to help.
Thanks for the call. And Stephanie Langer with Disability Independence Group in Miami, you are advocating in particular on behalf of students with disabilities, students who are especially vulnerable, and, you know, for students under the age of 12, especially, who are not eligible to be vaccinated. You know, we've heard mostly from those parents, Stephanie, parents of younger children who aren't eligible to be vaccinated, parents of kids who have some sort of disability or are immunocompromised in some way. Though that's the group of kids I think that there's the most concern about right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the mask mandates, when they have an opt-out, aren't really mask mandates. It's just an illusion of a mask mandate. And if enough people opt out, then there is no mask mandate. So the school districts that have created these opt-outs really aren't doing anything to protect our most vulnerable students. And it's like saying that there's a pee section in a pool and a non-pee section in the pool. If somebody pees in the pool,
I think everyone can visualize that. Yeah. Yeah. Charles Gallagher, let me ask you about that, because the governor is now saying, hey, I'm going to dock the pay of a school superintendent that defies me on this. The superintendent in Tallahassee, a guy named Rocky Hanna, said, fine, dock my pay. Take my salary away. I'm going to do what I think is best to protect the student body. You know, there are some superintendents who are trying to hedge their bets, in other words, as Stephanie said. They've given parents an opt-out so as to not get on the wrong side of the DeSantis administration. As an attorney, how do you see that playing out?
So first, from an equity standpoint, there are some heroes being created right now, folks that are standing tall in the face of these threats. And, you know, you have doubling down, and you have what's been done now is saying we're going to dock your salary, dock your pay. That's to a new level. I just don't see any legal support, any trial court in Florida saying, yes, we're okay with you enacting this executive order, you know, by fiat across the state. Oh, and by the way, when you go ahead and enforce this, which there's no legal basis to enforce it, against teachers and against those in leadership and school county board commissioners who are defying you, you dock their pay, take their money. That's similarly not supported by the law. So at the end of the day, you know, saying something and doing something and then having it executed in practice are four different things. I just don't see you're going to have any kind of support from a trial judge in Florida that there's a right to go ahead and dock pay of these individuals who are truly standing tall for the students, for the health of their environment. And I agree with Stephanie, the idea of having this commingled space of of mask to non-mask among these under 12s who don't qualify for vaccinations is the same thing as having a fully, you know, unmasked, you know, scenario. Yes, you're having some folks with masks, but when you have this commingled crowd with Delta and without the vaccinations for the 12-year-olds and under, it's a recipe for disaster.
549-2937. Ingrid in Clay County. Hi, Ingrid. How are you? Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thank you for talking with me. I have three children in my family, and they are not going to go this year to school because we're not being provided. They have IEPs, they have asthma, and the entire family decided we're not sending them to school. Only one is vaccinated, but he suffers from asthma as well. So I believe that Governor DeSantis he could kill our children. And what is he going to do when that happens? I don't understand why he's being so uncaring and he's not taking care of our children, my family. So I'm not going to do whatever he wants to do because I believe in masks. We wash our hands. We do everything. We follow all the rules. And now he doesn't want our children to be healthy. I do not understand that.
And will your children be in virtual school? Is that what you're choosing this year?
They're not even offering that.
They're not offering it.
That
yeah.
This year, no.
What are you going to do?
I'm thinking homeschooling because we are boycotting this thing that he's doing. If he actually said, let them mask up, let them have a little bit of safety, we will be a little bit like, okay, he cares. We can send our children. We know that they're going to be a little bit healthy, but with this Delta variant, and there's nothing that we can do about it, I'm not sending my children to school, and it's three of them. So thank you for listening to me, though. Thank you.
Thank you, Ingrid. Stephanie Langer, you are filing on behalf of parents like Ingrid. Some parents are choosing to pull their children from school in this situation.
Yeah, parents are terrified, and especially if they have a vulnerable child, they're terrified. And the governor has just created so much chaos that parents are don't know what to do. And if they have the ability to keep their children home, they are. But that family has just now been pushed out of the public school system. Those children will not receive an appropriate education, a free appropriate public education as they're entitled to by federal protection. And so it's just a disservice to those three children who won't, you know, get the benefit of being with their peers and in an integrated setting. And that's what we're hoping. That's what our lawsuit is hoping to accomplish. I think it's important to say that neither of anybody is asking for anything other than to follow the CDC guidelines. And the CDC guidelines right now recommend having masks in schools. And so it's frustrating that our governor will not follow the science at this point as it is. And parents are terrified.
Here's a tweet from one listener. We pulled our children out of the Duval system, put our house on the market, and are getting out of Dodge. Charles Gallagher, your complaint is already filed. And can you take us through the next steps of your lawsuit?
Certainly. So we ended up filing it Friday night, and then our next step is to go ahead and get the complaint off to all the different defendants. We have asked the DeSantis attorney if they would accept service of process informally in order to speed things up. In spite of that, our process servers are already on the way to effect service of process. In spite of all that, on yesterday, we received word from the trial judge that there would be an emergency evidentiary hearing at 2:30 on Friday. This Friday, so we'll have some quick opportunities to go ahead and brief the court on the issues that we see and present our arguments and present our testimony on issues that we want to have the court consider in this injunction request. This injunction request is meant to strike that EO down right now and have the status quo maintained without the executive order.
So theoretically, you could be granted an injunction this Friday, essentially invalidating the governor's executive order. Is that right?
In a temporary fashion,
in
sure.
In a temporary
fashion.
There could
be an order that's entered that removes its effect and strikes it temporarily for later, more robust litigation on the merits. But, again, freezing things as if there's no executive order for that pendency of that time frame during the fight.
By the way, a listener just sent us an email letting us know that the Diocese of St. Augustine Catholic Schools, they have just announced that they will be requiring masks indoors for all employees, faculty, staff, and students 5 years of age and older. Thank you for that information. Stephanie Langer, where does your federal complaint on behalf of kids with disabilities go next?
So similarly, we filed on Friday. We have served most, if not all, of our defendants through formal service. And now we have also filed for an emergency injunction to remove the executive order, which we believe is a barrier so school districts aren't able to make those decisions locally of what they need to do for their student population. So we are hoping to also get a hearing date on our emergency injunction motion, but to date we have not. So that's what we're waiting for the federal courts to act.
And again, for parents of children with disabilities who would like to join the federal complaint, how can they do that?
The best way is to call my office, 305-669-2822.
Thank you so much, Attorney Stephanie Langer of Disability Independence Group in Miami and Attorney Charles Gallagher with Gallagher & Associates firm in St. Petersburg. We'll follow these lawsuits. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
And much more still ahead on the show. Later in the hour, we'll tell you why some local restaurants are bringing back those mask mandates. But up next.
The See the Girl Monologues is really an opportunity for girls, young women, and female-identifying youth in our community and their caregivers to share their personal stories, to share their experiences with failed systems.
How you can see the girl in a special performance of new monologues. That's coming up.
How can the local news media serve you better? Hi, this is WJCT Editorial Director Jessica Palumbo, and we want to hear what topics interest you, when you'd like to read about them, and how you might want to lend your voice to the stories that your neighbors read. Help us shape the newsletter that we're creating for you. Take our quick survey now at wjct.org/survey. And thanks.
The Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT Public Media is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, profiles of local artists, and more. Turn your ear on the beautiful noise emerging from Northeast Florida and learn more about the local artist whose music is reverberating across the country. Visit jacksmusic.org to play it local and play it loud.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new performance of monologues designed to show the audience how girls in North Florida are dealing with a range of issues. For more about the upcoming See the Girl monologues, I spoke with Dr. Vicki Basra of the Dolores Barr Weaver Policy Center. Dr. Basra, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here today.
So what are the See the Girl monologues?
Well, the See the Girl Monologues is really an opportunity for girls, young women, and female-identifying youth in our community and their caregivers to share their personal stories and really to share their experiences with failed systems so that we can really impact change in our community by raising awareness through these stories and the sharing of these stories. And the vision of this project is really to bring this group of individuals together who have specific lived experiences, maybe, in the judicial system, school system, child welfare system, victims of human trafficking, basically have any kind of lived experience where they've been failed by a system or a policy in our community, and have them join a story circle, which will be led by Yvette Angelique Hayter Adams, where they will write their stories into a monologue format. And once their stories are written, then each participant will have an opportunity to either choose to actually perform their own monologue on stage, or we will invite a performer to perform their monologue if they don't want to. If they choose to perform their monologue, then we've invited performance coaches, Barbara Colicelli and Robert Arling White, to help coach them. And so then, you know, all of those monologues will be performed as a collective piece in 2022 at the Jesse Ball DuPont Center. And really, we hope that the performance will build empathy in our community, as well as inspire action from the audience to create space, you know, to create change in our community, create a response in our community, but then also create space of belonging for those who are taking the stage to share their stories.
And so by sharing these powerful stories, people watching the monologues, they'll really get a better understanding of how girls are interacting with Florida's criminal justice system and what reforms honestly are needed. That's what the Dolores Barr Weaver Policy Center is all about, right?
Absolutely. And our vision is that as we hear these stories, we'll also be able to connect research. The multitude of research we've been doing over the last year and that we continue to do to back up the stories of these young people, and to be able to share that it's not only their lived experiences, but the data also reflects that what these individuals are experiencing is true and valid in our community and across Florida and our nation.
How can girls get involved in this? Because as you said, the performances aren't till next year. So there's a lot of planning and prep work that goes into this.
Absolutely. So at the present time, we're looking for about 12 to 15 girls, young women, female identifying youth over the age of 12 and their guardians. So we are looking for pairs if a mom and daughter want to do it together, who are really interested in using their lived experiences to change minds, create new ideas, and, you know, who want to share their personal journeys to change laws and policies in our state. And they can find out additional information by going on our website and registering there.
All right, at seethegirl.org. Check it out, Dr. Vicky Basra with the Dolores Barr Weaver Policy Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having us.
Well, some local eateries are bringing back mask requirements and other safety measures. And this is due to the surge of COVID cases and hospitalizations in our area right now. One such restaurant is one of my personal favorites, 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield. Allison DiRizio is baker and co-owner at 1748. She's on the line. Hey, Allison, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to talk to you. So tell us what you're doing at 1748 Bakehouse right now.
Well, we have brought back a in-house mandatory mask policy. So unless you're physically sitting at your table, eating, are drinking, we ask that you wear your mask. This includes going to the restroom, coming back up to the register, or even getting up to leave.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying you're doing this to do your part to keep people safe. Are people yes. complying?
Yes, overwhelmingly. Absolutely. Most people, to be honest, who come in and don't have a mask on, because that always puts us a bit on edge right at the beginning, are simply, they've gotten out of the habit of it. So they're like, oh, I have one in my car. I have one in my purse, just a moment. And in that case, we don't make them go back to their car because we are urban parking. We have some at the desk that we, at the register that we give them.
And let me give a shout out to some other restaurants that are also bringing back mask requirements. El Jefe, Blue Bamboo, The Bearded Pig, Bono's, Prati Italia, and Town Hall, and others. What about the argument that once you take your mask off to eat, you've essentially negated any good you did wearing your mask the rest of the time? What do you think about that?
Well, that is an argument, but that's not science. So what the science tells us is that if you're in front of someone or directly adjacent to them, either to the side or face-to-face, when they're speaking, their particles come out of their mouth. They're, you know, this that comes out of your mouth, whether you like it or not. Heavy breathing, coughing, all of those things show that a face-to-face is much more dangerous than us standing, handing the food, and walking away. My staff is also masked the whole time, but there's a much higher risk of contracting it when you are face-to-face speaking to somebody.
Throughout this whole pandemic, have you had staffers get sick at any point?
Fortunately, we've had no current staff sick. We do have a very dear sweet baker that was with us for about a year and a half. About a year. He is actually currently in the hospital on a ventilator.
Wow.
So it's come very close to home.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry to hear that. That gives you an idea of how serious this is. As we speak with Allison Dorizio, baker and co-owner at 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield, she's a restaurant owner bringing back mask requirements because our hospitals are full of unvaccinated patients, including some children. And so what's your message to those who are really hostile to this, Allison, and they insist on going maskless and they don't like being told that they have to mask up when they go into a business?
We understand that not everybody is going to believe what we believe, but we feel like it's a very, very small ask for a huge outcome. And if they make the decision that they don't want to wear a mask, we have given them several options. They can do a call-in. We can bring it to the curb. They can prepay. We can take our mobile Square payment system out to them, but we do not allow them to stay in the shop. We thank them for their business, and we kindly ask them to leave.
Would you prefer that the mayor or some other authority bring back a mandate? Do you feel this puts more onus on you as a business owner?
100%. I think what it does is I had a conversation with my new front of the house manager, and I said, before we decided to go back to mandatory, I said, are you prepared to deal with this? Because I do not want our part-time staff, our younger staff, being berated, because that unfortunately does happen. We've had people rip their masks off and throw them at us, open the front door, throw their masks inside, tell us how, you know, ignorant we are. So I don't want the few and far between, obviously, of those interactions to happen with our hourly staff. I think everybody has enough stress in their life. They don't need to deal with someone's temper tantrum.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the people that have been under the most stress through this whole time are healthcare workers, but right behind them, I would put business owners like you, restaurant owners. What's been the toughest thing for you as a small business owner and a restaurateur throughout this whole pandemic?
Well, initially, it was just simply the lack of business. You know, when we stopped having seating inside, and we went to takeout only. That was very difficult on us. We really are grateful to all of our customers, and a huge shout out to them for continuing to come and do takeout meals and that sort of thing. And then it it went from that to a real staffing issue. So we've had a difficult time. I need a full-time baker, and I just simply can't find one. So many people are hiring that people are moving to, they're taking, you know, other jobs in other cities or other areas, or maybe they've gotten a signing bonus. So I'm competing with a very small labor pool for staff that has experience. So that's become the hardest thing. And just simply, we can't afford another shutdown. If we go back, we've been fortunate, and we understand that. But there's so many businesses who have not survived, or who still don't have indoor seating, or who are cutting hours simply because they don't have the staff to manage it. Mm-hmm. And that's heartbreaking to me.
Yeah, I mean, that has been so completely obvious to all of us. Where mm-hmm. whenever we go into a restaurant, we can see how stressed the staff is, because you are facing all of these issues. So, right. You know, it's incredibly divisive, and it's so unfortunate, Allison, that it has to be that way, because this shouldn't mm-hmm. be politicized. This is simply common sense and public health.
Correct. And for us, it's not a political issue. It is absolutely a love your neighbor issue. Watch for other people, putting, you know, someone you don't know who's taking care of an elderly parent because they're the only option. You don't know who has recently had chemotherapy and have come out of it. You don't know whose child is immunocompromised or who's immunocompromised on themselves. And I think that it's incredibly arrogant and unkind to say, well, those people should stay home. That is just not the way we should behave as a society.
I want to thank you for the delicious treats, first of all.
Absolutely.
And also for appearing. She's Allison DiRizzio, baker and co-owner at 1748 Bakehouse in Springfield at 8th and Main. Now instituting a mask mandate for diners, along with a lot of other eateries around the community. And you know, folks, even if there isn't a mandate, just be courteous and mask up when you go into businesses and stores. Allison, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Be well.
In a moment, an idea for your bookshelf this August, as we speak with our Fearless Book Club leader, Stacey Goldring. That's next.
WinGuard, a Jacksonville-based marketing and communications agency, provides Northeast Florida businesses with services to help with their reopening, such as digital and social media marketing, local advertising, and public relations. More information at wearewindguard.com.
Ascension St. Vincent's. CARE is listening and delivering personalized plans from a team of specialists dedicated to providing the latest technology and treatment at every step. Information and appointments at getjackshealthcare.com.
Thank you. Observant Muslim women in Turkey are fully covered when they're out in public, and for some of them, their hijab is a fashion statement.
Because for us as a hijabis, it's the only thing that is showing.
Now stores in Istanbul are selling fashionable hijabs in bright colors with breathable fabrics and chic designs. The rising popularity of modest fashions on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Scott Tong. The EU is planning to charge a carbon border tax. It might spur other countries to do the same in an effort to cut carbon emissions.
Economists want a global, worldwide program to reduce carbon emissions, not just programs targeted at specific countries.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
As more than 50 million students return to the classroom, there's a fierce debate over mask mandates. Schools and the CDC say they're needed to keep everyone at school safe, but some parents say only they have the right to decide what's best for their kids. But what do the students themselves want and need? We're handing the show over to them next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, if you're still looking for an end of summer read, we've got an idea from our fearless leader, Stacey Goldring. Her pick this month, a book about the famed designer of Central Park in New York. But the great Frederick Law Olmsted was so much more than that. He left his footprints in a lot of places, including here in Jacksonville. Stacey, good morning. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too, Melissa.
And it's good to change topics from all this depressing pandemic news. Tell us about this book, Genius of Place.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think at some point you're going to open up a book and you'll just find me smashed happily between the pages because I feel that's the best place to be. And certainly nature has all the answers. And this book, Genius of Place, about Frederick Law Olmsted by Justin Martin, is just the book for our tumultuous times. And you're absolutely right. His footprint, his imprint, goes way beyond the meandering, beautiful paths and vistas of Central Park. In fact, we can find his influence and influences and influencers right here in Jacksonville in Nina Comer's Gardens. And also, he is also connected to Harriet Beecher Stowe right here in Mandarin, from where I'm speaking to you this morning. But this man, Melissa, is such an inspiration. Let's just put a pin in the whole nature thing. And because I'll be talking about that actually at the Comer in November. But this is a man who was willing to throw everything at the wall and see what would stick. He tried all types of work. He flunked out of college. He sailed to China. It was a complete disaster. He tried to be like his brother. That didn't work. He tried farming. He tried everything. And, you know, you could look at it through the lens of, man, I've just made all these mistakes. I'm never going to get my act together. Or, like Olmsted, he just tried all types of things and I'm sure you can relate to this, it all kind of lines up. All his experiences doing all these things where someone may say, oh, you failed at this, you failed at that. Mm-hmm. Au contraire, it all lined up where all of a sudden he finds himself in charge of constructing a Central Park. And then from there, his career really takes off. And, you know, with everything going on in the world right now, Melissa, and we're all so concerned about public health. Here was a man who had no medical training whatsoever, and he ends up in charge of the United States Sanitary Commission, which was in charge of the medical health and welfare of the entire Union Army during the Civil War. So all of his skills, organizing, being in charge of a farm, planning major garden, all these things just keep ebbing and flowing and aligning, and he just kind of followed that path. He never looked really at anything, you know, as like a failure, but just another step. So I find him so inspirational. you know me well, so I am of the school of let's just see if this will work. Let's give it a shot. Let's try. And you know what? You're the same way. And he is a testament that it's make mistakes. Go out there, try things, and beautiful things can result. And we can see it right there at the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens in that backyard.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, the Frederick Law Olmsted Garden at the Kummer Museum.
Right. So you can see the influences of his design in the gardens that Nina designed. And don't be misled. Everything is placed for a reason, from the color of the leaf to the texture to the shape. It plays in design. It plays in perspective. It plays in your experience as you take each step, as you walk on the brick and you feel that, you know, the soil or the grass hits your foot. That is all purposefully done. And it's Frederick Law Olmsted who opens up this whole world that we now know as landscape architecture. So the next time you go to the Riverside Arts Market or you walk into a nursery and you see plants for sale, you can thank him, because we weren't doing this kind of thing before he came along. We weren't thinking of looking in our backyard and thinking, well, I want to make it look like this, or I want it to feel like a grotto, or I want it to look like when I was out at the beach or in the mountains or whatever. That's all a result of his genius of place, which is why the book is just so well titled. So I highly recommend this book.
Yes,
and I also want to invite our readers to come to our book club that begins next month, either online or in person.
That's right.
Which is very exciting. Well, yeah.
And how can people join Stacy's book club?
It's super easy. Just go to chapterendnotes.com and sign up.
Chapterendnotes.com. And pick up this month's pick, Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted by Justin Martin. And email Stacy, too, with ideas about books. Email her at bookclub@wjct.org. Happy reading. Stacy, see you soon.
Okay, bye.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, associate producer Catherine Hobbs, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield, along with the entire WJCT News team. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for being with us, and catch our podcast up later today on all platforms. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Mask up.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.